I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is writer Stephanie Danler. She's joined in conversation by Jordan Abel. And now, join Jordan Abel on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Stephanie Danler.
Tonight, we are joined by Stephanie Danler to discuss her debut novel, Sweet Bitter. Stephanie holds an MFA in creative writing from the New School. She went and got her MFA 7 years after working in restaurants, and there is so much to discuss about that journey. None other than Gabrielle Hamilton gave it a rave review in the Times, calling Sweet Bitter the kitchen confidential of our time, written from the cleaner and infinitely more civilized front of the house perspective. So please join me to welcome Stephanie Danler. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is so lovely. We are so happy to have you here tonight. So I'd love it if you can tell our audience of the people who have not yet read the book, what you would tell them about the book and how you would maybe describe and encourage them to read it.
This is great because when you publish a book, your editor actually does this for you, because when you start out, they'll be like, what's your elevator pitch? And you're like, I have no idea. Writers are often really bad at describing their own work. So I will tell you that Sweet Bitter is a coming-of-age novel set in a restaurant. It's about a young woman who moves to New York City, and she gets a job at a fine dining restaurant that is loosely based on a historic restaurant called Union Square Cafe. Danny Meyer is a New York restaurateur. It was his first restaurant. It's really kind of a landmark for service and hospitality. And while I did not feel that I had to stick to that restaurant exactly, I did work there. So it is loosely modeled on that place. What happens at the restaurant is really her sentimental education, as I see it. We start with her development of a palate, and that is champagne and oysters and truffles, but it's also drugs and sex and intimacy and becoming an urban creature, learning the kind of codes and customs of New York City. That sort of loss of illusion story with all of its mini and major heartbreaks. So that, I think, is how we have decided to describe this book.
Wonderful. And can I ask you to read? You mentioned the oysters
yeah.
and champagne. Would you read a bit?
I would.
And I'll pour us some wine.
Yes. This is a gorgeous wine from the Jura, which is also in the book. After service, the dishwashers rolled up the sticky bar mats, and the smell of rot rose from the blackened grout in the tiles. The kitchen was a hollow amphitheater of stainless steel, still, but holding the after effects of the fires and banging and shouting. The kitchen boys were scrubbing every surface, rubbing out the night. Two servers sat on the lowboy eating pickled red onions from a metal tin. Leftover ice cream sat on the bread station turning to soup. Hey, new girl, I'm in here. Me? Jake was in the doorway of a walk-in. He had a cup full of lemon wedges in his hand. His apron was streaked with wine. His shirt sleeves were rolled high, and I could see his veins. Are you allowed to be in there? What I meant is, do you think about me the way I think about you? Did you like them, he asked. The oysters? When he said the word oysters, their flavor flamed on my tongue as if it had been lying dormant. Yes, I think I do. Come in here. His tattoos showed themselves as he pressed the door open wider. I passed under his arm, looking back to make sure no one was watching. I'd never been in any space alone with him. Are we going to get locked in? What I meant is, I'm scared. Inside, there were two open beers, the Schneiderweiss Aventinus, a bottle I'd pulled for the bar but never tasted. The beers were propped against a cardboard box labeled greens but filled with little neck clams. We were in the seafood closet. Crimson tuna fillets, marbled salmon sides, snowy cod. The air nipped at my skin, smelling like the barest trace of sea. He dug through a wooden crate labeled with masking tape, Kumamoto's. He pulled out two tiny rocks, discarded the debris. A strand of seaweed stuck to his pants. "Those look filthy," I whispered. "They're a secret," he said, "quite a leap of faith." His voice was quiet with the motor of the fridge, and I shivered, moved toward him. He pulled a blunt knife out of his pocket, wedged the tip into an invisible crack, two switches of his wrist, and it was open. "Where'd you learn to do that?" He pinched a lemon over it and said, "Take it quickly." I flipped the shell back. I was prepared for the brininess, for the softness of it, for the rigidity and strangeness of the ritual. Adrenalized, fiercely private. I opened my eyes and Jake was looking at me. He said, "They're perfect." He handed me the beer. It was nearly black, persuasive as chocolate, weighty. The finish was cream. It matched the oyster's creaminess. The sensory conspiracy made the blood rush to my head. My skin broke out in goosebumps. "Ignore him. Look away." I looked at him. "Can I have another?"
Well, there's a lot.
Trouble.
Amazing.
Trouble, trouble.
Yeah. We will return to that trouble. I'd love to talk a bit about your path. It seems clear that so much of the book, and from what we know, so much of the book was inspired by your work in the restaurant industry. And so I'd love it if you could just tell us about when you moved to New York in 2006 and that found that first job, and then, you know, going and getting your MFA.
Yeah, absolutely. There is this idea that first novels are autobiographical, and so I'm always kind of up against this, how much of this is true, and what was your experience actually like, which I don't mind talking about because I was actually much better at my job than the protagonist of this novel. She gets a lot of biographical detail from me. I moved to the city at 22 years old. It was 2006. I had that apartment in Williamsburg. But the essence of the story is probably the most autobiographical aspect, which is this falling in love with the food industry, thinking you're going to get a temporary job while you wait for your real life to start happening, and finding yourself fully absorbed by this life and the lifestyle and the knowledge that you're gaining, finding that there's levels of professionalism and expertise that mean that you can grow, finding that people have benefits and healthcare and people have kids and own homes that are just servers. That's very particular to New York. I've been working in restaurants since I was 15 years old. I've done every job, dishwasher, hostess. And so I knew, for me personally, I moved to New York to become a writer. I went to undergraduate for writing. But I already knew that restaurants were where you went to protect your art, to make enough money and to give yourself the time to create. However, New York City restaurants and San Francisco restaurants and LA restaurants now, but not back then, the level of intensity, right? The level of knowledge that your casual server has about wine is so far off the charts. And I became addicted to that. I mean, after I left Union Square Cafe, I went to wine school for 2 years. I opened wine stores. I became the beverage manager of a small restaurant group. I was the general manager. And I wanted for nothing, right? I had this very fulfilling life that I wasn't seen represented. Every kind of representation of being a server is that it's a joke and you're really an actress. And it's this job that people leave off of their resumes, but I took it very seriously.
And but while you were taking it seriously, were you still thinking, I'm a writer, but I'm...
You know, I have a daily writing practice, but I was not taking notes for some grand restaurant masterpiece during that time. I really had put that aside, and I loved my job. I loved the life that it was mm-hmm. giving me. Coming back to writing took the form of like a mini crisis, as it often does. But I stopped considering myself a writer. That's the truth.
And did you think really that you were building a career in this industry, the food industry, that would be where you would be and be happy?
Absolutely. No, I owned two restaurants at a certain point. I was involved with the opening of them, and that was me, right? You're signing leases, and you have sweat equity, and you've worked for 7 years, and in my case, my entire life to make it to this point. I never thought I would abandon it. That moment came of recognizing that if I did not write this book right now, I would never do it. And it sounds very dramatic, but I talk to so many other writers where you have that kind of life or death split where it feels like a matter of survival. But it's important for me to honor when I'm talking, right? And I'm on tour and everyone's like, of course you should have left your job and written a novel. That it's not an of course. It was so terrifying. And people mm-hmm. took me out to lunch and were like, please don't do this. Right. My mentors, my family, like, please don't take on these loans. Please. And I'm like, no, I'm 30. I'm going to write a novel. It's a great idea. This cannot possibly go wrong. And that kind of, like, I think the seriousness with which I took that risk, how invested I was in that old identity, made me work harder in graduate school, is the truth. I finished the first draft of Sweet Bitter in the 2 years I was there, and it was because I felt I had given up so much. I did not take 1 second of my schooling for granted.
And was it always a given for you that in order to write the book, you would want to get an MFA and go to school and not write it on your own?
It's an interesting question because I'm ambivalent about MFAs. They're hard to justify. They're very luxurious degrees. And I don't know that you really teach writing in a graduate program. What I do know is that when you go to a program like that, you're giving yourself the time and the space and the community. And each one of those things is a massive gift. And I decided to give myself those gifts, but I could have saved a lot of money if I just like started working part-time. I couldn't do it. I'd been managing restaurants for so long, and I'm sure some of you are in this industry. It's a 70-hour work week. It is your entire life. And to think that I was going to suddenly break from that and enter a new mental space without help from teachers and classmates, I wasn't strong enough. And a lot of people come to me and they ask whether they should go to school or not, and it's a deeply personal decision. And my answer is, if you have an idea for a novel and you are willing to work your ass off for 2 years and treat this like a job, then yes, you can go to graduate school, but it's a tough decision.
But ultimately, a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to justify, but it worked out.
It's okay in this case.
Yeah, in this case. And so by the time you actually did write the book, you were 7 years after moving to New York. Is that right?
I moved at 22 and I got into school at 29 and started really pushed. Mm-hmm. It was like 30. So yeah.
And was it hard to put yourself back in that place to write?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. I was so drunk when I was 22. I don't remember any of it. So I have this daily writing practice, which I thought would save me, right? And I go back to my notebooks and they're just like, it's gray today. I'm anxious. And I'm like, this is useless. This is just... They were not helpful at all. So here I am, a decade older than my narrator, mm-hmm. trying to remember what it felt like to to be brand new to the city that I now knew, you know, it's a part of my fiber. It was really hard. I identify more with the older cynical characters in my novel, the people that are really jaded and kind of mean. And to think about this buoyant, optimistic young thing that she has so much hope, it made me feel very old. But, you know, there was lots of triggers. There's the music, and then once the plot is entirely imagined, right? So once she became fictional, then it was easy. It was when I was trying to remember myself at 22 that I was having difficulty. But when I started to think of her as her own entity, making her own decisions in the face of people that I had never really known, that became easier.
And was thinking about sort of the strong food writing tradition of Gabrielle Hamilton and Ruth Reichl and Anthony Bourdain and all of these, where they are writing more from a memoir place. Was that ever something you considered, or was it always a novel for you?
It was always a novel. I really love nonfiction, and I love this like hybrid autofiction that we see a lot now, where I could have just passed this off as a kind of fictionalized memoir. I love how messy and human they are, but I really love the grandeur, for lack of, I mean, that's like a really pretentious word for it, but of creating something bigger than yourself, of not telling the story of my misspent 22-year-old, 23-year-old youth, but creating a heroine. And I was really inspired by Isabel Archer from Henry James's novels, and by M.F.K. Fisher, a food writer that I deeply admire, who wrote this kind of coming-of-age collection called The Gastronomical Me. And I wanted to incorporate the kind of, like, universal brand newness that felt much bigger than my story. It felt like it could maybe relate to more people. I think that's what novels can do, right? Mm-hmm. They're empathy exercises.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that once Tess was a character, mm-hmm. it was easy to go with, or not, probably not easy, but easier to develop her and keep her separate from the jumping off point of you when you were in New York in your early 20s. But I'm curious about her story, which is so relatable and universal, as you talked about. It's that coming of age story, moving to a new place, finding something that you can connect with. And that's very relatable, but in some ways I think her character is not necessarily likable. Mm. And that's an interesting dynamic for me, and I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, that has been so interesting to me. The question of likability, because, of course, I find her likable. Not because she does the right thing all the time, but because she's very sincere. And for me, sincerity, true sincerity, you can get away with a lot. And so as I'm asked questions about likability, and as I hear from readers that are really wanting to nitpick her voice, I wonder what it is that we want from our female characters in fiction, where there's just some sort of distaste for when women hurt themselves, right? Or when they're self-destructive, or when they wander into morally ambiguous territory. And I think that is what we're talking about. I hear other female authors and female television creators get asked this question about likability. Why often the characters are called narcissistic and that are superficial or mm-hmm. privileged. But I think we really don't like to see women making mistakes or women in peril. I come back to that again and again. And to have her be likable, I do think she's likable, but that's a fairy tale. Mm-hmm. That's not a real story of a girl that is testing all of life's experiences on herself.
You're listening to writer Stephanie Dandler, whose new book is Sweet Bitter. She's joined in conversation by Jordan Abel on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
The coming-of-age genre is full of fairy tales for the most part, which is something I was very aware of going into it. And I thought, how can I subvert these fairy tales? How can I end this so that she is proud of herself and has more ownership of her voice, but she doesn't get rewarded with a boyfriend or a job promotion? How can I show that growing up doesn't happen in this grand epiphany, flash of lightning? It's all of these micro movements, and the majority of the movements are backwards, but that doesn't mean that the little ones forward aren't still victories. I mean, I really wanted to push people's boundaries with that. Mm-hmm. And so I made her very human and mm-hmm. very flawed. And she does some things towards the end of the book as she's kind of spiraling out that, readers get upset. They mm-hmm. get very, mm-hmm. very upset. And I think that means that I've done my job, right?
Yep. Yeah, very effectively. And speaking of things that upset readers,
oh God,
shall we talk about Jake?
Mm. Beautiful disaster.
Stephanie, yes. Yeah. And I think a lot of us have had mm-hmm. Jakes in our life. Have you had a Jake? Was he based on a real person?
He is based on so many people. So Jake is this, like, drop-dead gorgeous tattooed bartender that has the emotional maturity of an 11-year-old and will never develop past that. And I really didn't want it to be like, maybe she can change him. She thinks maybe she can change him because she's 22, but the reader is supposed to look at Jake, the adult reader is supposed to look at Jake and be like, oh, this? Yes, I remember how this ends. It doesn't end well. So I think a key difference between Tess and I is I spent all of my 20s married, essentially. I was married. And I did not – I watched the women in my life get pummeled by these Jakes and try to decipher their kind of leaden sentences and tell themselves all these stories about how this time it would be different if I just do my hair a little bit differently or if I'm just patient. And, you know, and then I have had my experiences now with people who I thought that if I fixed them, I would fix myself. And that's what's happening there. And I'm so grateful for those experiences because they helped me write this book. But I think we all have that, right? Whether it's with a beautiful bartender or whether it's with parents or friends or people that we're attracted to that consistently hurt us. But we believe if we can stop their suffering, we can somehow stop our own suffering. I think that's pretty universal. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the being attracted to what you can never have, which is, you know, a neurosis that we can't seem to cure ourselves from.
I wanted to circle around to it, and you referenced it, you know, that dynamic in a relationship isn't necessarily only a love interest dynamic of trying to fix someone and trying to save them. And you wrote a piece in Vogue about your father having...
Oh, boy.
Yeah,
no, it's great. No one ever... I write nonfiction as well. I'm very proud of my nonfiction, but no one ever reads it. This is fantastic.
it was public... I mean, it was...
Yeah, no, it's out
Vogue.
There.
It was out there. You write that he had suffered from addiction and was out of your life most of the time, and there was a period where you moved in with him in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, as comfortable as you might... to share with us about that and that connection.
I am comfortable. The connection, you know, my therapist was the first one to connect the Jake character and my father. You're not the first, but you know, my father is a drug addict that I do not have a relationship with, and I love him deeply, but that's been after a decade of rehab and a lifetime of neglect. He wasn't in my life as a child. Learning to draw boundaries around myself is the single most important thing that I've ever done as a person. It has saved my life numerous times, and that boundary was hard to draw, and I don't think I would have learned it if the situation hadn't been so extreme. And that's really what Tess is doing with Jake, is trying to learn to draw boundaries around herself. Whenever we're in a toxic relationship, until we know what the bottom line is, until we know what we will take and what we will not take, we're going to be hurt. Like, the story will not rewrite itself or revise itself to a different ending. And so that essay in Vogue was really about the decision to not have him in my life, which is obviously very fraught to this day. But the most important, it's the moment I became an adult, really. It's the moment that I said, you brought me into this world, but I actually won't accept this behavior anymore. And another important part of that essay is how often I fail at that, because it's a work in progress. And I wish that boundaries were real, actual walls put around us, but they're in our heads, and they're imaginary, and they're permeable. I hope that it's better for us, because we can still feel the good. But, you know, it's a complicated, ongoing process.
Yeah.
Loving people that hurt you, I guess, is how I would put the banner over that.
Yeah, and something I think everyone has experience with, for sure.
Of course.
We were in the green room talking a little bit. You mentioned boundaries just now. We were talking about your decision to leave New York, to move out of New York and move to Los Angeles, where you live now. And your reasoning for that I thought was very interesting, and I was wondering if you would share that.
Yeah. I think that it can be detrimental to artists to be in the center of their industry sometimes. And before the book was coming out, I was already getting attention that I wasn't fully comfortable with. And I love sitting here and connecting to readers, but I was getting attention for getting a book deal. My book wasn't out. It felt invasive. Attention for being a waitress that got a book deal. Like, it's a miracle. And I was still waiting tables when an article came out in the New York Times about my book deal. And I had $400 in my bank account, and it was a Saturday night, and I was going to be working till 4 a.m., and all night people were coming in. And as we got towards midnight, they were drunk, and they weren't that polite. And I thought, oh, I did not sign up for this. I'm a writer. I sit in a room by myself. Like, this is not the kind of attention that I want. And so I decided that I would leave New York before the book came out to really protect myself. And it has been so crucial to what I've gone. Sweet Bitter has done better than anyone could have expected. And I've been on tour for 6 months, and it's such a privilege to still be invited to speak places. But if I did not have a boundary around myself, I have never read a review. I've heard that Gabrielle Hamilton review quoted 100 times. Never read it.
Wow.
I don't read Amazon reviews. There is some nasty about me on the internet. I do not go searching for that. Like, you really have to protect yourself. And not just because it will hurt my feelings. No one cares about my feelings. But if I'm going to make art, if I'm going to, like, continue to push boundaries and push myself, I can't have that in my head. I refuse to. So it was about protecting the writer in me. And Los Angeles seems counterintuitive because it's like a funny town, but it turns out they don't read. So no, nobody knows who I am or what I do. And it's great. They're like, you're a screenwriter. I'm like, no, it's called a novel. Don't worry about it. I'm very happy here.
So no regrets with the move. Do you miss New York?
Do I miss New York? I've spent like 6 months of this year in New York, so I haven't gotten to properly miss it yet. I was ready. I was really ready to go. It's always been this kind of backbreaking, beautiful place to me. Because the entire time I was there, up until I got this book deal, I had multiple jobs, like 6 days a week. I had this work schedule that I equate with a city. It's just this adrenalized, punishing intensity. And I do not want that right now.
Yeah. When you do go back, are there like immediate stops? You have to go get this from this place or go look at this view? Do you have like a hit list?
Yeah, of course. Right? I mean, everyone does. Do you have one? She left New York as well. We were bonding over this.
I'm sure a lot of us have left New York here tonight.
There's a scene at the end of the book that takes place at Grand Central Oyster Bar, and that's one of my first stops always. And I really miss the museums. So I usually, you know what I really miss is just walking. The just walking for hours and hours and being like, oh, this is an hour away. I will just walk from uptown to downtown and watching the landscape change and the architecture change. And that's kind of my first order of business, I think.
And have you, as you're settling into your new Los Angeles home, started to develop your haunts in LA and your places that...
No, not really. I haven't, like, dug in yet. Everything is still new, which is so exciting to be 32 and to have been known this one city so well and then to be in Los Angeles and experiencing a new city. I do have some routine. I do have like a few things. The Hollywood Farmers Market has oysters for breakfast, and I'm the hiking, right? I moved back to California so I could be outside and run outside. So that's part of it.
Thanks. I want to return a bit to the book. And I wanted to ask you about the title, actually, Sweet Bitter, if you can tell us where it's from and why you chose it.
Yes. If you ever write a novel in graduate school, you will know what you think about your own work before it ever gets published, because every single week someone will be like, so I hate the title. And I'll be like, I don't want to talk about the title. And they'll be like, so this character is like really unlikable. I'll be like, I don't want to talk about that anymore. You do this over and over again for 2 years. As soon as I knew that was the title, I was reading Anne Carson, who is a poet, and I was reading her translation of Sappho, who's an ancient Greek female poet, and she is commonly known as the first poet to call love bittersweet. And Anne Carson is translating, and she says, actually, I'm looking at the Greek, and it's sweet bitter, which is the order that love goes in as well. And she wrote an entire book called Eros, the Bittersweet. It was her PhD thesis. But that was it, right? That is the order of love. And then I thought, what really is growing up except distinguishing between what is sweet and what is bitter, what is good for me, what is bad for me? And so before I had Sweet Bitter, I had the opening line, which is... the first thing I submitted in graduate school was a short story, 25 pages, called Sweet Bitter. It had the same first line, the same last line. I read that oyster scene because it is exact. It came to me from God knows where, and it is almost to the letter what I wrote in that first draft. I had Simone's voice. I had visions of Jake. But this, you will develop a palette. That's the opening line of the book. That's the plot. That's everything that happens. I saw it all from that first sentence, and the same is true about Sweet Bitter. I saw everything that happened, how she would run the gamut from sweet to bitter and come through it marginally better than she started.
The poems, I mean, there's the poetry that we just discussed, but there's also a lot of poetry in the book that you've written as well.
So I have a hard time calling... I never thought anyone would call those poems because I have too much respect for poetry. I read mostly poetry. I would never try to write poetry. Those to me, I call them the chorus. They are a Greek chorus. They are the first person plural, the we voice. And really all I was trying to do was match what it sounded like in a restaurant. When you're picking up stray fragments of conversations, you don't have time to finish your sentences. Things are repeating, right? Mm-hmm. Certain phrases all the time, but with a slight variation, which lets you know you're in a new moment. That to me was like being in a tunnel and thinking about dinner service and how you're moving through it and you're so task oriented, but you're always picking up the stray bits of dialogue. And so I wanted a way to show that. I mean, the whole structure of the book is these short vignettes, and that's also to mimic dinner service, where scenes don't necessarily have beginnings or ends. They just are like, flash, I'm in the kitchen, oysters, great, and I'm moving on to the next thing. It's meant to give you that feeling, that kind of rush and of chaos. But poetry was huge to the book in other ways, mm-hmm. right? I think about each of these vignettes as kind of an exposed moment, which is something I learned entirely from poetry. There's Frank O'Hara has a poem that begins, it's untitled, and it's Light Clarity Avocado Salad in the Morning. And I kept it tacked above my workstation because I thought, this is what food can do. Light, vague. Clarity, really vague. Avocado salad in the morning. Bam. I'm in the scene. I have been given presence. And so every scene, whether there's food or not, I wanted it to have that feeling of this kind of like illuminated moment based on the poems that I love so much.
Yeah. The use of food, set in a restaurant, but the way that you use food to convey emotion and feelings, and it's almost like food is kind of a character, mm-hmm. the way that I read the book. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how Tess's sort of palate develops over the course of the book, or how maybe yours did when you were working in restaurants and those connections.
Yeah. So I had been working in, right, I had my first oyster when I was a child. I was raised on a beach town in Southern California. So I had my palate, and I knew the difference between red and white wine, which she barely does in the beginning of the novel. But some things that stuck out to me when I moved to New York was learning about eating seasonally. The book is arranged by seasons in order to reflect the food and the weather, which were the two things that were always on my mind anytime I wrote a scene. And I remember my first heirloom tomato. And growing up in California, we have tomatoes all the time, year round. But your first like purple and yellow tie-dyed heirloom tomato in New York City that is only in season for 3 weeks, I had never tasted anything like that. Now, what's really happening there? You are paying attention to food differently. You are paying attention in a way, and this is like from the novel, in a way that's close to worshiping. Once you start to slow down and really taste everything and look at everything that you're putting in your mouth and spend the time with it, it lights up your life. It transfers to everything. All of a sudden, you're looking at a sunset and paying attention to it with that same level of detail. And you're listening to music differently. And that is like a total, like, metaphysical to physical sensual awakening. And that happened to me. And that, to me, is developing a palate. Technically, developing a palate is learning how to talk about things, right? Learning the language for food and wine. And that's a part of her education as well. But I was really thinking of this sort of religious conversion, right? It is like worshiping food and wine and pleasure and the body and letting it kind of filter out over everything you do from there.
And the way that you write about food, so that graphic way of writing about food, which we heard when you read. Also, you're very graphic and upfront when it comes to sex in your novel.
Right, yeah.
And so I'm wondering if that was uncomfortable for you to write about or easy? What was your relationship?
So easy. Oh my God. No. Writing about food and sex, you're just like alone in your room and you're just like, oh yeah, I have got this. Adjectives are flowing. And then you read it the next day and you're like, this is all That's great. So the question of sex came up a lot because I knew that I didn't want to fade to black, right? Which we see so often in television and in books. We get up to that like intense fulcrum point and then the camera moves away. And I thought, if she's paying attention to an oyster like this, I can't have her cut out when it comes to sex.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features writer Stephanie Dandler, whose new book is Sweet Bitter. She's joined in conversation by Jordan Abel. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
From a technical standpoint, if there are any writers in the room, you come to the moment where you're like, what words am I actually going to use? Like, because it changes the nature of your book. And I thought, I'm going to be very graphic because she is very graphic about food, but it did not feel true to Tess. She has this kind of lyrical, ecstatic, romantic point of view. So to like devolve the language quickly did not feel entirely true to the character. I definitely, the thing with writing about both of those subjects, food and sex, is that the reader, when it becomes gratuitous, the reader can tell and loses interest. Everything has to be essential to the story. So that oyster scene, I could have stayed there for probably like 5 more pages and I could have had her reflect on it like, oh, that was arousing. I think I like him. That oyster. But instead, I thought, let's get into the moment. Let's take the story where it needs to go and then let's move away. And that's what I tried to do in the sex scenes as well. There's no gratuitous sex. It's all a moment that changes her. And so I tried to use the same language for both of them. There were a lot of cut sex scenes that will make its way into an erotic novel that you guys will never know that I wrote. Changing my name. I'm not kidding, actually. I've talked to my publishers about this because it's just so much on the cutting room floor. And there's a great scene about anchovies that had no place. And, you know, you lose a lot when you write a novel.
So I do know you had signed a 2-book deal with Knopf. So will the second book be a romance novel?
No, it will not be. No. Knopf's going to kill me. You did not hear that.
That was a joke.
Yeah. The second novel. I have been focusing so much on my nonfiction recently. I have an essay about moving back to California and California's drought that's coming out in January in the Sewanee Review. And I do travel journalism, and I just got back from Peru writing a piece on the Sacred Valley. And that seems like a perfect place to put my energy because last weekend I had 5 flights in 3 days and I leave for Miami in 2 days. And I don't know how anyone would write a novel given the schedule that I'm on, but you can write an essay, right? I mean, it's like a short adrenalized burst of energy. That said, I have been like, things have been coming to me that I'm very excited to sit with, and it will be a novel. And it will be different from Sweet Bitter, but it will not be my erotic fiction novel. You really won't even know it's me. You might. There might be food in it. And everyone will be like, that's her.
Yeah. We'll know. Yeah. No one else might, but we'll know. So I have to ask, do you ever get sick of the food world?
What? No.
Never?
I mean, no. The burnout rate for food industry workers is like ridiculously high. I want to say that it's right behind doctors, but I might be inflating it a little bit. I miss it so much. I think that working in the food industry when you're an artist is such a safe space to be extroverted, to go in and like try on different personas and be flirtatious and then go home and read Virginia Woolf for 2 days and not talk to anyone. And I miss that balance a lot. I get sick of certain aspects of the food industry. I get sick of say anything against Anthony Bourdain, but I get sick of that depiction, which is part of the reason that I wrote this book, this like testosterone, rebellious, aggressive knives and drugs. And my book has knives and drugs, but I wanted to show kind of a different side of the food world. I feel like we see the same all the time, and now it's been inflated so that it's like the subject of reality television, and that's just like a false sense of celebrity, and lots of bad behavior comes from that. But no, I miss the food industry every day.
Would you see yourself returning to it?
I'm scheming every 5 minutes. I'm here talking to you, and I'm also thinking like, oh, what can I open? What can I do? And it's a real illness, to be honest, to everywhere I go in the country be like, great, I'm going to steal that, and I'm going to make a wine bar with that, and I'm going to do this. I can't work the way that I did work in it. But I will definitely find... I really think that if you treat all of your obsessions seriously, and like, they will come together at a certain point. Being able to talk about food and writing, like, I never thought that day would come, but I feel like if I keep it as a priority, it will stay in my life.
What did you eat while you were writing?
Oh, God. This is really sad. That's a good question. So I always imagined, in Virginia Woolf's diary, she has her writing schedule. And it's 3 hours in the morning, lunch, 1 hour of correspondence, 2 more hours of writing, like, and then dinner, 6 days a week. And she's incredibly prolific. And I thought, oh man, when I stop working in restaurants, I am going to be so civilized about this. I am going to be on this. But I've never had a job, like a 9-to-5 job, ever once in my life. And so I write in these crazy binges where, like, I don't brush my teeth, I don't shower, I'm just like locked into my computer like it's a 10-hour restaurant shift. The Chinese food guy is like, really? I'm back here again? I just dropped food off 2 hours ago. And I'm like, don't judge me. It's really disgusting and very feral. And I think that that is something that I struggle with, because when I try to get myself on that 9-to-5 schedule, it's like, I should be cleaning the house, or I should be working. You have to put those hard brackets around it. This is my writing time. I'm not leaving the desk to go to the farmer's market, even though it will be a better Instagram photo if I do. I'm not going to call my friend, even though she is pretending to need me right now. You have to be really strict about it. And that includes for me cooking. So I ate like crackers mostly, like bags of crackers.
And can you tell us what makes a great server? A great waiter?
Yes, I can. Education, right? From my end, from working in management, an educated server is often a great server because they have something to share with the guests. They have an experience to be an ambassador for. At a micro level, like eye contact is probably the beginning. I am pretty easy on servers because I understand how hard that job is, but I do expect a real human level of attention. And it's when they become robots, when they're overtired, that servers are at their worst. So that as a customer, I'm looking for eye contact. Mm-hmm. And I'm a rarity in this case. I'm looking to give myself over to my server. I know how smart these people are, and I know that they have a job to do, and that they know their wine list better than I do. They know what the best bottles are, what I should order. And so it's really about making that connection so that I can give myself over to them completely. And as a server, those were always my favorite experiences. When someone would come in and be like, she medium seems like she knows what she's talking about. And I would be like, I'm going to blow their minds right now. They don't even know what's coming. They're going to have a white wine from the Jura that they think is like oxidized and disgusting. But then they're going to realize as it becomes room temperature that it's creamy and amazing with this risotto, blah, 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 blah. Still got it. So, yeah, I think you have to really find ways as a restaurateur to engage your servers. And what Danny does so well, Danny Meyer, is he has an ethic that we can attach ourselves to. He has this philosophy of hospitality that you can really invest in. My character could have worked at a TGI Fridays. She could have worked at like a Balthazar or a Thai food place. But I wanted her at a place that made her feel like the best version of herself. And that is what he does so well. So all of us baby restaurant people try to do the same thing.
That's great. Well, I have a million more questions, but I want to make sure we have plenty of time for your questions. So I'm going to turn the question asking over to the audience.
You've mentioned other food writers, Bourdain and others.
Mm-hmm.
When I read your book, I thought of the part about food and wine. I thought of Liebling.
Oh my God! Yeah,
So my question. Yeah. Thank you. But my question is, how much of your food writing in the book is experienced, and how much is writerly skill?
It's all based on experience. That is, I would have a hard time writing. That's just such a great question. I would have an almost impossible time writing about a food experience that I hadn't had personally. I really have to have lived that material. And as far, I would say all of it is writerly skill, right? As far as how I'm able to communicate it. But I don't know that I fully have that imagination to write about beef bourguignon in Paris in the 40s. I couldn't do it now from where I stand. That's a great question. And I don't know that who is a food writer that can imagine meals? That is a real question for like the people that read about food, because this is not, that's Liebling's nonfiction as well. So who is imagining it? I don't know that it's possible. You'll get it wrong. That's a good question.
Hi. I really love the relationship between Tess and Simone, because I felt like it was this like frenemy relationship, and like so few writers get that dynamic between women like write. So I would love to hear you talk about like where you came up with the character and like your inspiration for it.
Yeah. Simone is ostensibly Tess's mentor, but she has an attachment to this awful man, Jake, that makes it into a sort of love triangle. And first of all, this is all borrowed from Henry James' Portrait of a Lady. It's not a secret. Dangerous Liaisons uses the same plot as far as this older, manipulative, maybe toxic, incredibly charismatic woman who has people that worship her in place and can't really have the status that disrupted. And this connection with the younger, naive, vulnerable woman who she takes on to train and then has to destroy or try to destroy, right? That's an old story, but I was so fascinated by someone like Simone because she's the woman that stays at the restaurant too long. All of her aspirations and all of her vigor have turned to bitterness, which is something you see again and again with people where that industry is not a fulfilling life unto itself, but a trap. And so to me, their relationship is the main artery of the book. And Jake is just auxiliary, because like it's really boring to have this male love interest because it's always going somewhere erotic, whereas all the erotic longing between the women has to be put into something else. And I think that's why female friendships are so crazy, because you don't have an erotic outlet ever. It's all your power struggles are internalized. And The other thing that's really interesting about Simone and Tess to me is this idea that Tess is searching for family the whole time. There's family meal at the restaurant. Restaurants are instant family. I watched this happen a bazillion times with these kids that flee their hometowns to come to New York, and instantly they want to be absorbed into a new family. They want their father figure, Howard, in my book. They want their mother figure. They want their brother, like, because they're also destabilized by being estranged from family units. And so there's a lot of maternal longing and projection between Tess and Simone as well. And I think that, as we spoke about earlier, familial relationships can be potentially dangerous as well. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun to write the two of them. They are the main relationship in the book to me, 100%.
To go back to the Simone and Tess relationship, mm-hmm. to the beautiful aspects and the loving aspects between them,
mm-hmm.
and listening to you speak tonight, I wonder if you could talk to us about a time when you were the Simone and the beautiful parts of the Simone.
When I was like 25, I became a manager of a restaurant in New York City called Tia Paul, and I was managing people that were my same age, and they were behaving like hooligans, and I had to say no to them, and they laughed in my face, and I would be like, you can't drink during work, and they just like pour the wine even more. I'd be like, this is a nightmare. Saying no as a young woman is really, really difficult. Saying that kind of like that level of discipline. But I also got to teach them about wine. That was like a huge part of my job. And I remember those first classes and my voice shaking and not believing that I had the authority to speak to them. And I'm going to get like a little teary. And like when they like get it, when they're smelling and you say like, this varietal is really known for jasmine and green apple. And do you smell that vanilla? It's new oak. And they're like, yeah, I totally get it. And I was like, this is it. It's the teaching moment. It's the epiphany. And I'm bringing that layer of sensuality and attention to detail into their life and changing them. And so what Simone is loving about Tess is her openness and her energy, because it reminds her of her own youth, but she's also loving watching this person discover. And it's a teacher student relationship. And I had that all the time, and so, so grateful for it. It actually is so informative for like a young woman who doesn't feel qualified to do anything to start to own her knowledge. And that was really formative for me. And I'm still using that skill set right now, like as we speak, literally.
Thank you. Thank you so much,
Thank
Stephanie.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's program features writer Stephanie Dandler, whose new book is Sweet Bitter. She's joined in conversation by Jordan Abel. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.